Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. You know, patient advocates are, what would we call them? We call them professionals who help people get the medical care they need from an, I would say, often bewildering healthcare system. And we have a couple of experts today to talk with you about this whole area. Angie Ingraham is a former trauma and critical care surgeon who founded True North Patient Advocates. And Angie, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on, Larry. I really appreciate it.
Appreciate having you here. Chris Van Haren was a pharmacist. I think probably both of you guys are still practicing or could be practicing. Let's put it that way. You're licensed.
Mm-hmm.
Chris Van Haren, a former pharmacist who now specializes in insurance and billing advocacy. And she is the founder of A Better Way Professional Health Advocacy, LLC, both of them are. And Chris, good to have you here.
Good morning. Thank you so much.
As we talk with our experts, I hope you'll join in the conversation. Have you been frustrated with your medical care in one way or another? Or if you have you had some problems with maybe getting an insurance claim turned down or getting the kind of care you need? I hope you'll join in with your own questions, comments, or maybe experiences to share. The number is 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email to talk@wpr.org. Well, both of you have had careers in healthcare, now work with patients in different areas and capacities. Maybe we can start by talking about what led you, each of you, to what you're doing now. Angie, let's start with you.
Sure. So I was a professor at UW and Department of Surgery for nearly 10 years. When just about 5 years ago now, my dad got diagnosed with a brain cancer.
Oh.
And he, thank you for that. You know, he got different care, not only because he had an advocate by his side in me and my brother, who also was a physician, but because we had knowledge of the medical system. You know, he got access to different tests. He got different care. His transitions of care between hospital and rehab and home went more smoothly because he had somebody there. And it's just something that has stuck with me. And, you know, I said if we're struggling with this because we have the finances and the means and the education and the time, I know other people are too. And I actually found out about professional patient advocacy through Chris and through the Wisconsin Patient Partner Group at UW that Meg Gaines founded as well. So It's a whole world, and we're excited to be here to share knowledge and experiences with the audience today.
Yeah, great. Chris, what about you? You were a pharmacist, or
I'm still licensed.
Yeah. You're still licensed,
just in case. So Angie represents probably about half of our certified advocates across the country who come to advocacy because of a loved one who had some medical issues, and they want to share what they've learned now with others. And of course, Angie has, you know, additional expertise in the medical field. I actually came to advocacy in probably the other half of the way the other half did, which is because I was a pharmacist, part of the medical team, I saw people fall through the cracks. And I thought, there's got to be a better way to do this, hence the name of my business. And so I transitioned by going to the Center for Patient Partnerships here and under Meg Gaines. Fantastic program. Unfortunately, they no longer take non-traditional students like me. But great program, taught me a lot. I thought things I thought I knew. They taught me a different way. And so I come at this from the background of a part of the healthcare team, but also just trying to share my experience and my expertise that form.
Well, it's great to have you both here, and you're doing wonderful work, that's for sure. And Fred Nalma has a question for you. Let's just turn there. Fred, thank you for calling.
Good morning. The reason I was calling is yesterday I was going to do some refills on some of my medication, and one that I'd been getting for many years, but I was surprised when the cost to me went up by an order of magnitude. I was paying roughly $15 for a 90-day supply, and it is now over $140 for the same amount of drugs. I'm on Medicare and have purchased, you know, a drug plan that I was on last year, and I'm still on this year. So what my question really is there anything that I can do to effectively complain about this tremendously steep increase?
Yeah. Well, let's turn to Angie first. Or Chris.
I think Chris. This is right up Chris's alley. I can help, but Chris can help much
all right,
more.
Chris, we go to you.
So, first of all, Fred, thank you so much for calling in today. Can I ask you what the pharmacist told you when you picked up your medication this last time?
Well, what I have been doing is using a mail order service.
Okay. So nobody contacted you. It was just a surprise.
Yeah.
It was a surprise.
Okay.
And then so I went and I did a pricing search of this drug on their website, and they list a number of local pharmacies like Walgreens, mm-hmm. CVS, where I can go and pick it up, but the price is essentially the same.
Yeah.
I tried searching for a local pharmacy, and nothing would come up.
Okay. So a couple of things. This could be for a number of different reasons. At the beginning of the year, drug plans, including Medicare drug plans, often have a deductible that needs to be met before you can go back to whatever your standard copays were. So it's possible that you have a deductible that needs to be met first. And once you meet that deductible, that price will go down from now on through the end of the year. The only way you're going to know that is to look at the details of your prescription plan, your Part D plan. Sounds like you have traditional Medicare plus a Part D, or do you have a Medicare Advantage plan?
No, that's what you first said is what
okay.
I have.
Okay, mm-hmm. Okay. So it's important to find that information about your plan and whether they have a deductible or not to meet. Probably the best way to do that is to access your Medicare Part D card that they sent you and call the customer service number on the back of that.
Yeah. That might be the quick way.
That's the quickest. Well, I don't know if it's quick anymore. It might be the quickest way. It's unfortunate that they don't list any local pharmacies for you, but that could be why the price doesn't change depending on what you're searching for, is because you might have that deductible to meet first. That's probably the most likely thing. The other option is that some pharmacies are no longer in network, even though you have the same plan. The networks can change, but because you're doing mail order, that sounds like that's not the issue here.
Yeah. Well, Fred, good luck. Take a look at that plan, and at least hopefully it'll work out the way Chris is talking about here. At least you. Sometimes, what would it be? $500 or something?
Oh, who knows? They're
who
all
knows?
Different. Yeah. I'm sorry. There's one more potential option that if it's a, depending on the medication, there are formulary changes that Medicare D and other prescription drug plans do every single year. In fact, they happen throughout the year. They don't happen just once a year. And it's possible that the medication you are getting is no longer on their formulary, or it has done something they call changing tiers, where it's a different cost depending on what level they put that medication at. Again, it's less likely that that's the option, but again, it's a good question to ask when you call the Medicare D plan. The customer service number is to ask if you have a deductible to meet, and then also ask if this is in the formulary and what tier it's at.
And Fred, good luck. Thank you very much for calling. You can join in too. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email the talk at WPR.org. Is this the kind of thing that you, one aspect, I guess, of what you do?
One of many.
Yeah.
So patient advocates cover a wide range of services.
Let's talk about those services.
Sure. So everything really is tailored to our client. It can be help finding a doctor. So if you need a second opinion, helping to identify appropriate doctors for you to go and see. It can help with preparing for doctor's appointments, going with clients to doctor's appointments, making summaries of the doctor's appointments, helping to coordinate care after a doctor's appointment, helping with transitions of care. So I've had clients who are in the hospital, then they're going to the rehab, then they may be going to an assisted living or going to home. As independent patient advocates, we work for the client, and so then we travel with the client across all those different states and those different locations, and we can travel across systems. So it doesn't matter if you're with hospital B for this doctor and hospital A for that doctor, we can go with you because we work with the client, not for the hospital or the healthcare system.
And you can do it virtually, too? I mean, a lot of it's probably virtual.
Absolutely.
Yep. So advocates are not licensed in a state, so we can work across the United States. But there is a board certification for patient advocacy, which involves a test and continuing education to make sure that we're providing services in a professional and ethical manner.
So somebody might say, well, I'm drowning in healthcare costs. Can I afford? How can you afford to hire, in a way, let's put it the general way, how can you afford to hire a patient advocate?
Sure. It just depends on what your needs are. I've had many people contact me with medical debt that they don't know what to do with. I just talked to someone yesterday who said, I believe all of my medical debt is now in collections, in multiple different collection agencies. I get phone calls every day. I get mail. I'm so overwhelmed. I don't even open it anymore. I set it aside. And I get it. That's what happens. We get overwhelmed and we ignore it. We wait for something to happen and hope that it's going to be good. So what I recommended for her was to set aside a time based on her capacity, her ability to process everything, focus on just collecting all that mail and emails if that's part of it, open them up, see what they say, see where things are, and we can address it from there. So with medical debt, there's sometimes options for financial assistance through collection agencies, depending on how they operate, and through the medical facilities. If somebody has debt of, say, $50,000 and it's going to take me, 10 hours to fix it, and rates, rates vary across advocates. So some of us have sliding scales. I actually have some pro bono slots. They're fillable right now. but that changes periodically. But if we're talking about $50,000 and let's say, I don't even know how many hours, because 10 hours isn't a very rough estimate. I often think 10 and then it takes 20. So let's say that you have $50,000 and you're paying $10,000 for somebody to address that, which I think is high. But let's just say if you're able to bring that down in some way, shape or form to where you're owing, $10,000, $15,000, $20,000, you've saved yourself money in the long run. So you kind of have to assess where you're at and what your needs are. And I do a free consultation, free 15-minute consultation. So, we can talk that over and see if it's worth it for you to hire me.
Yeah.
No pressure.
Yeah. Angie, anything to add to that?
Yeah, I just had a client the other day, a son of a woman who had an inpatient rehab stay denied. And they had submitted an appeal, and they lost that appeal, and they were debating whether or not to submit the second appeal when I got engaged with them. And they submitted the appeal, and they won. And his comment to me was, you've just proven your model, you've proven your worth, because they would have owed all of that money out of private pay if they hadn't won that appeal, and they wouldn't have submitted the appeal without my help and my encouragement. So, you know, we are here to help people get the best possible health care that they can. We're also here to alleviate some of the stress, overwhelm, burden, confusion. It's just too much right now because our healthcare system is so complicated, and there is help out there for you and your family.
Well, we have callers online, and we will get to those folks. Maddie and DePere, we'll get to you in a minute or two here. The number for you to call in, and we do have some open lines to get you on pretty quickly, 800-642-1234, or if you'd like, you could email us. We have some emails as well. Email address, talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Just a quick note, Dr. Zorba Pastor will be joining us at the top of the hour to talk about a whole variety of issues. Right now, we're visiting with Angie Ingraham, who's a former trauma and critical care surgeon. She founded True North Patient Advocates. And Chris Van Herren is a former pharmacist who now specializes in insurance and billing advocacy as the founder of A Better Way Professional Health Advocacy. And again, join in, numbers 800-642-1234, email to talk@WPR.org. Let's go to Maddie and DePere. Maddie, thank you for calling.
Thank you. I have extreme dry eye disease, and generally speaking, I'm happy with my insurance company, but they do not cover MIBO, and my bowl, from what I understand, has some kind of oil in it that helps to the eyes to stay moist longer. And so I'm really concerned that I might go blind someday because of the, I guess the, when you have extreme eye disease, sometimes it's caused by the poor quality of your tears. My eye doctor tested my tears. I do have inflammation in my tears. And So she just was approved to have to do a $2,000 procedure to put a film over my eye to protect it, to give it time to heal. And to me, that's like penny wise and pound foolish for the insurance company to not pay for the $200 a month MIBO for me.
How's that spelled, by the way? By MIBO?
I'm not sure. It's like M-I-B-O-L? E-B-B-O-W.
Okay.
I see it advertised on TV.
Got it. Okay, well.
So that's a prescription, Maddie?
Yeah. That's a prescription.
Okay.
Eye drop.
Okay.
I'm not, $200 a month.
There are lots of newer ones I'm not familiar with. Sorry.
Yes,
first of all, Maddie, I'm
so
sorry.
It's M-I-B-O-W.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Maddie, I'm so sorry that you're dealing with this. It's so frustrating. Like you said, penny wise and pound foolish. I completely agree with that. I think, so this is something that you can definitely talk to your eye doctor about. There are probably other medications that may work as well. As with the previous caller where I mentioned the possibility of a drug not being on the formulary with your insurance, it's entirely possible and probable that in this case, that's what's going on. They may cover other medications that work similarly to this medication. So I would definitely talk to your eye doctor and see if they can switch it to one that is on your formulary. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think it makes sense to me. That's for sure.
Yeah, I think the other thing, and Chris, I'd like to get your thoughts on this too. You know, there are some drug discount programs. So we've been talking about going and getting access to your medications through your insurance. But there are some, you know, some of the manufacturers have discount programs so that they can reduce the cost of prescriptions. Now, it is important to note that sometimes those programs are only for a limited amount of time. So it's not that it's an indefinite reduction of the cost of your medication, but that sometimes can also be a way to lower costs cost of your medications, and pharmacists are a great resource to help you identify those programs as well.
Yeah. Previously, when I was working as a pharmacist, we weren't necessarily aware of those. So advocates are still the best way to find those programs. But Angie's absolutely right. That is a possibility. They do tend to be for medications that are for serious chronic illnesses. This is a pretty specific illness that you have, disease state that you have. And so I'm not sure if that would be available for this or not. But certainly worth checking with your doctor as well.
And stay listening, Maddie, because Phyllis in Winona, Minnesota has something to say about MIBO.
Hi. Okay, first of all, it's M-I-E-B-O is the prescription.
Okay.
And I am on that same medication, and honestly, it is very helpful, and I don't know if there's anything else quite like it. To get it through my insurance, and I'm sure all insurance is different, but on mine, I had to have a prior authorization from my doctor, so they had to say, I've tried this, that, and the other thing, and they didn't work, and then finally my insurance would cover it. But in the meanwhile, while I was trying to wait for that to happen, I found basically the same product available online from somewhere overseas, and I don't know whether you guys recommend that or not. It was called Hycosan Shield, H-Y-C-O-S-A-N Shield. And the ingredients seemed to be the same. You know, I felt fairly comfortable using it, you know, and I think it's the same product. But, I mean, I guess if someone's really desperate, that's an alternative that they consider if their insurance absolutely will not cover it.
So, Philly, I wish you could have seen the collective gasp between Angie and I when you mentioned ordering something online. Ordering things online can be very helpful, and they can also be very dangerous. And the problem is we don't know which one it's going to be until we start using it. I'm glad that you found relief. That's fantastic. You do bring up a couple of good points. When you talk about prior authorization, that is often required when drugs are not on the formulary, and sometimes it's required even when they are on the formulary. So it's important to contact your prescription drug insurance coverer to find out what needs to be done. And if that's not something you can do, have your doctor's office do it. The second point is that you were able to get the MIBO approved after what's called step therapy. You have to try and fail usually 2 to 3 other medications before they will cover it. Still requires a prior authorization, but you do have to go through those steps first. It has to be documented in your medical chart. It has to be a certain amount of time, even sometimes. So 3 months, 6 months, a year. So yes, excellent points. Thank you so much for bringing all of this up. And I'm glad that you're finally on it and you're finding relief.
Yeah. Phyllis, thank you very much for calling. You can join in too, 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Kent in Reedstown emailed, I don't know if you can answer this, wonders if you can explain what Medicare for All would look like.
The phrase Medicare for All means different things to different people. Mm-hmm. Some people call it Medicare for All. Some people call it universal health care. Mm-hmm. Some people call it, I don't even know. There are lots of names for it. And they truly mean different things to different people. So there are lots of nuances to Medicare. It's a bigger discussion than just getting our health care. It has to do with reimbursement for physicians, reimbursement for pharmacies. It has to do with the stability of the entire healthcare system based on payments, based on all kinds of things. So while I completely agree with the people who say our system is 100% broken, I don't know what the answer is. And I don't know. I really can't speak to that piece. I don't know if Angie, you have a...
Yeah,
no, idea.
I mean, I think it's in general, it's an idea where we provide the same type of coverage to everyone, even though you may not be of age to qualify for Medicare. And I think, you know, as we talk about insurances, one kind of light bulb moment that I had when I was learning about Medicare is, you know, we have traditional Medicare where someone has a Part A and a B plan and a D is a drug plan. And then there's this Part C, which are the Medicare Advantage plans. And really what a Medicare Advantage plan is the government has given these private companies, you know, such as Humana or UHC, the private insurance companies, the money to provide health insurance for the people who sign up for those plans. So Medicare for All is just kind of like a different way of providing coverage to a larger number of people who are outside typically of that Medicare age.
Yeah. Makes sense. Alice emailed to ask you to talk about the good prescription types of plans. The good ones. Oh, GoodRx. GoodRx type of plans. And how did they work?
So GoodRx is not an insurance plan. It's a coupon program. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people have used it to bring down the costs of their medication. They have a database on their website that will show you what the average price is and what the price is with their coupon. Again, there's a lot of nuance behind it as far as who gets paid what. It may save you money. It may also be not paying the pharmacy even the cost, not even covering the cost of the drug sometimes. And that happens with insurance companies too, where they don't even cover the cost of the drug, but they bring the price down for you, which is great and not sustainable in the long run. So the issue with using GoodRx is that, again, this is everything has a but or a caveat. So if it's a medication that you're paying $200 for as a copay, and it's never going to change, it's going to be a $200 copay all year, and GoodRx has it for $50, well, I would do that, right? The thing is, if you have that deductible to meet, and if you have that maximum out of pocket after which your insurance company pays for 100% of that drug, anything that you run through GoodRx that you pay the GoodRx price does not get applied to that. So if your drug costs $200 this month and $200 next month, and now you've met your max out of pocket for the year, you're not going to pay any more for that for the rest of the year. If you're going to use that GoodRx coupon every month, you're paying $50 per month times 12 months. Yeah. You're going to pay more for it in the long run. So it's really
running the numbers.
Yep. And again, you may need the pharmacist help with that. You may need an advocate's help with that. You may need your doctor's office help with that. Whoever can assist you in doing that. Maybe a family member. You know, my mantra is everybody needs an advocate. And sometimes those advocates start out to be family members and friends.
Yeah. I was looking at some numbers, and I'm not sure if these are exact, but 12% of Wisconsinites have medical debt collection.
That's probably a low number.
Probably. Oh, my goodness. So you probably both have to deal with that in one fashion or another.
It's a topic of discussion no matter what you're dealing with, no matter what you're talking about. That's always in the back of people's minds. Yeah. How am I going to pay for this?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I don't know that the actual statistic, but we know that medical debt is a leading, if not the leading cause of bankruptcy in the United States.
Yes.
You know, and so part of our role is to help clients and their families navigate through that, get the things that the insurance company should be covered.
Right.
Because it's not always easy. I mean, you know, to give a real world example, I have a client who had a stroke, has partial paralysis. So he has weakness on one side of the body, and we're in a process of getting an appeal for his wheelchair. You know, there are some basic things that everyday folks are struggling to get coverage for, when it's a required and necessary and should be covered through their insurance. And so we're here to help with all of that.
How could that not be covered?
That's a great question.
What little writer in small print at the bottom of the paper of your insurance company would say, oh, and by the way, if you can't walk, we're not going to provide you a wheelchair.
Right. When we talked to the vendor of the wheelchair company, the company that supplies the wheelchair, they said that the insurance company that we were going through, they always deny, and that we always have to have an appeal. But the lay public doesn't know. Sometimes you don't know that you can appeal, or you don't know that if you lose your first appeal, you can submit a second appeal, and a lot of people actually win their second appeals. But it takes knowing the process. It can take knowing what words to include in the appeal. And it takes time and energy, and you know, that's something that is at a scarcity right now. So
yeah, and I'm just thinking about this goes back a few weeks, but I was talking to some friends who are elderly and had gotten a turn down, but then the paperwork involved.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
He finally just said, "All right."
And the insurance companies count on that.
Yeah. You know, I will say that it's not always the insurance company, though. So the very brief story of kind of why I got into advocacy was started with an experience with my dad. So my dad had a surgery scheduled for a Wednesday. He had surgery scheduled for Wednesday. He had an MRI scheduled for Tuesday. And Monday at 3:00, we got a call saying that his MRI was canceled because we didn't have prior authorization. So I kept them on the phone for 2 hours. I moved the MRI to the afternoon. The only thing that got us to that MRI was that his PCP was a friend that I went to medical school with, so I texted her.
Mm.
Once the paperwork got submitted, the insurance company approved it right away. In that case, it wasn't the insurance company denying the MRI. It was that the hospital system hadn't submitted the paperwork that was needed to the insurance company. And so a lot of what advocates do and that we help with is all of that care coordination, because there are so many moving parts to keep everything straight and to make sure that things are getting done to make these care plans and these the things that need to happen to have people get care go smoothly. Like, that's a lot of what we do.
That's a really good point, Angie. There's a lot of breakdown in communication,
mm-hmm.
whether it's verbal communication, written communication, faxed communication, e-prescribed communication, mm-hmm. whatever it is. There's a huge breakdown because, let's face it, we had a mass exodus of the healthcare system after COVID. And so we're short-staffed. Everybody is short-staffed. And so things get dropped. And they get missed and they get set aside and forgotten, and not on purpose. Mm-hmm. They're just overwhelmed. The entire healthcare system is overwhelmed right now. And the patients are the ones who get left holding the ball and holding the financial responsibility. Mm-hmm. And so we're here to walk alongside people and, you know, facilitate that communication for better care for people. So agreed, Angie.
Annette in Green Bay has a question, I believe. Annette, hi.
Yes, hi, Larry, and your guest. My question is in regard to the amount that either the doctors or hospitals charge, say, for any kind of procedure. And for sake of argument, it's $100, and the insurance company, Medicare or whomever, say, well, we're only going to pay $20. And the medical community accepts that $20, that $80 differential, what becomes of that differential? Is that a tax write-off so they don't pay taxes? Or why do they charge such a high rate when they know they're only going to get reimbursed about a quarter of it?
That's a great question. That is a great question, Annette. Do you mind if I take a stab at that?
Yeah.
Okay. So
go ahead, Chris.
So it's kind of a game of cat and mouse. Okay. Mm-hmm. So the hospital says we're going to charge $100, and let's pick Blue Cross Blue Shield. Blue Cross Blue Shield says we will send our patients to you. We will put you in network if you accept only $50 for this instead of $100. And they get to decide, the hospital gets to decide, okay, we do or we don't want to. Is it worth it? Again, run the numbers. So if they only get half of what they're charging, they're going to increase their rate so they get half of a higher rate. And it's going in circles.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't believe, and I don't know this for sure, but I don't believe there's a tax write-off. It's just what's in their contract. And that's why it's so confusing for hospital billing departments and all billing departments, too, is they don't know what the what's in the contract. They only know what the information they get back from the insurance company. So even the new thing with, you know, everybody has to have an estimate available for what their care is going to be. That depends on the accuracy of what information the insurance company is giving you back. It depends on whether the deductible's been met. It depends on all kinds of things. There are a lot of places, a lot of room for error. So it depends on the contract. It depends on which contract they're billing through. So they may have a separate one through UHC, which says they'll get $30, not $50. So it's this, yeah, it's this big circle that just keeps going around and around because everybody's trying to get their piece of the pie, right? And the hospitals need to be paid enough to cover their expenses and, you know, in order to stay sustainable. If we don't have hospitals that are sustainable, we have nowhere to go.
Mm-hmm. How many hospitals do we have in the state? 175, 180?
There is something like that. And small hospitals in rural settings are closing because they're being eaten up by larger conglomerates, or private equity, which is a whole other discussion.
I was thinking about that because you've got, what's the percentage? About 28% of the people in the state live in rural areas. And only about 11% of the doctors work in rural areas. At least I looked that up before the show, and I think that those are accurate, pretty accurate figures.
Yeah.
Again, that's a whole other discussion about access to care.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and how do we really keep patients, you know, patients and families want to stay local. They want to get their care locally when they can. And so one of the things that the major academic or the major tertiary centers, the higher level of care centers is doing is, you know, how can we keep patients to get the quality care that they need and deserve in their rural communities? Because guess what? The major centers are all full. They don't have the capacity to have patients be transferred from their rural hospital into a higher level of care. Because there's no room in the inn. So a lot of the efforts in Wisconsin hospital systems, I've talked to the leadership at these institutions, is how do the major centers partner better with the rural hospitals so that patients can still get good care but get it closer to home.
Yeah, and I saw some. You've done some research on this as well.
Yeah.
I can remember some of them. I mean, like 45% of all the transfers that go on in the state go to UW hospitals?
Yeah. So there was one study we did of emergency general surgery patients. So patients with appendicitis or gallbladder problems or skin and soft tissue infections. And UW actually accepted patients from 70 different hospitals, all coming to UW for those different diagnoses. And so we did a lot of research on how to improve the care coordination and communication that happens between the referring hospitals and providers and the accepting hospitals and providers at UW.
It's an amazing, amazing figure. Our guest today, Angie Ingraham, is a former trauma and critical care surgeon, founded True North Patient Advocates. And Chris Van Haren, a former pharmacist, now specializes in insurance and billing advocacy and is the founder of A Better Way Professional Health Advocacy. Our guest. Questions, give a call at 800-642-1234. You could email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks for joining in today as we talk with some medical patient advocates. Angie Ingraham, her business, True North Patient Advocates, and Chris Van Haren, former pharmacist, who's founder of A Better Way Professional Health Advocacy. Barry in Madison has something. Let's go there. Hi, Barry.
Good morning. I just want to expand on the question about the definition of Medicare for All. Medicare for All essentially means that the government, through additional taxes, would pay for everybody's health insurance. And one of the big advantages of that is that obviously you can go to any doctor. Everybody is covered. You don't end up going bankrupt because of excessive costs. And right now, if I'm not mistaken, the cost to insurance companies for doing their work on covering expenses or parts of expenses is approaching 40% of the costs. So I think people ought to be, I guess, a little bit more aware of what Medicare for All is, especially since most of the major economic countries in the world with advanced economies like ours, almost all of them have free health insurance.
Yeah. Thoughts or comments? Chris, you want to take a stab?
I just want to say that thank you for your comments, Barry. I appreciate that. I appreciate you expanding on that discussion for us. Unfortunately, in the U.S., I can't speak for other countries, but in the U.S., when we talk about healthcare, we can't do it anymore without talking about politics as well. They've been inextricably
linked,
intertwined. Yes. So that's a bigger issue. Clearly, it's unfortunate because we should be focusing on humanity and treating each other as human beings. And I think healthcare is a human right versus anything else. So yeah. It's a very big discussion. I think it's going to go on for a while. I don't know if you have anything to add, Angie.
Yeah. No. I mean, I think it's we really do need all parties coming together to solve this issue. It can't be just the politicians. It has to be many different facets that have their hands in these pots and influence this to come together to really make meaningful change in healthcare.
Barry, again, thank you for calling. Dana in Manitowoc, we'll turn to you. What's on your mind?
Hi. Well, first of all, I just want to say thank you for opening my eyes to a new service out there for patients. I'm a palliative care home-based RN case manager in Manitowoc, so one of our rural communities, and 100% agree with you. This is a service that is much needed, in our culture today. The other thing that I just wanted to share that I haven't heard you talk about yet are just some other resources that are out there for seniors if they're listening. That would be the Aging and Disability Resource Center in their county, as well as their senior center. Both have outstanding people who can help you get started and answer basic questions and point you to individuals with more training as needed. But thank you for what you guys are doing. It's definitely needed as a case manager in a small rural town. Definitely there's lack of help for patients, and I'm glad to learn about a new resource for patients. So,
Well, Dana, thank you very much for calling. Comments?
Yeah, thanks, Dana, and thank you for what you do. I think you bring up a lot of really great points, and one of them for me is, you know, we as patient advocates, we partner with other people who do similar things like we do. So if we were engaged with a client, we would be partnering with you if you also worked with that same client and family. This is a very much a collaborative profession. We are here not only to support the client and the family, but also to support the providers, to support the nurses, to support the caregivers, to support the home health or home care providers. It very much is, I like to think about it as like forming a little cocoon around the client and the family and bringing all the different pieces together to support their health and their healthcare journey. And you are totally right. There are so many wonderful resources out there specifically for seniors and other populations. But the ADRC is a great and place to start, as well as your local senior center.
Agreed. Yeah, awesome. I just want to say, too, I'm going to echo Angie and say thank you so much, Dana, for all that you do in your roles. We appreciate you. And I'm sure your clients do as well. So the other piece that I want to mention is that we don't just work for seniors. Mm-hmm. Most of my clients are actually under 40. So we advocate for people of all ages for lots of different reasons. So,
and I'm wondering, let's say Dana or somebody in Dana's in Manitowoc, for example, is if there is not a professional such as yourselves, are you do you work outside? I mean, maybe via online or in some other fashion than maybe. I know you, you work a lot directly with a person, but wondering about that.
Yeah, so, I mean, our services can be provided virtually. So I've had clients in Iowa and New York State. I have clients in Ohio. And the, I think the other thing to note, and we can link this to the show notes, is that there are databases out there of professional patient advocates. So, you know, the our show, your show is being streamed across the nation. People can find people in their own local area if they want by looking at some of these databases that are organized by professional patient advocacy organizations as well.
So do you have that? Do you have the way to get that information?
Yep, yep. We can definitely provide that to you.
If you can provide that to us
absolutely.
Soon after the show, we can post that. A copy of this show will be up in 2 hours after the show is over.
Yep, absolutely.
So if you can send that to me, our Joel Patnod, right away, that would be wonderful.
Yeah.
And most of my work is virtual. I don't do a lot in person. Most of my work is virtual, and there are so many things that we can do virtually that, that don't need. Sometimes it's really helpful to have that person boots on the ground,
yep.
right? No questions. But if you don't have anybody local, the next best thing is virtual.
Ann in Madison, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Ann.
Hi. I was just wondering if people with insurance get billed a higher or the costs of a procedure are higher than what it could be. What about if you don't have insurance? What kind of bill will you get?
Unfortunately, you get that $100 bill where the insurance only, one insurance agrees to pay $50 for it, one insurance agrees to pay $30. You as the patient get charged $100 for that. So, which is why I, you know, in a lot of cases, depending on your income, there's the ability to negotiate that sometimes. And I hesitate to say negotiate because that sounds like everything is you know, a tag sale, a garage sale, and you can name your price. But that's not the case. But there is some flexibility sometimes depending on your financial status. So,
yeah. And Mary, do you have a quick question for us?
Yes, I did, and I'll be real quick. Just a comment. My husband and I are under 60. We have what I consider fairly good workplace insurance. This is more about the hospital and the clinic and the coding system. Just real quick, my husband's required to have yearly colonoscopies as long as they're medically necessary. We meet with the surgeon, which is, you know, time for him, time for us. We get the codes all set, and then somewhere through the loop of the clinic and hospital billing, they will slap a screening on top of what was supposed to be just a medically necessary procedure.
In 15 or 20 seconds?
Yeah, that's something you need to talk to the billing department about. You can talk to your insurance company first to find out which codes they cover and how they cover them, and then talk to billing and say, this is what's covered. Can you help me understand and potentially change
corrected.
Depending on right, depending on what's going on?
Right.
That makes sense. And it's been a pleasure talking with you both. Thank you so much. We'll get you back and do this again.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Angie Ingraham is, her business is True North Patient Advocates. Chris Van Herren, her business is A Better Way Professional Health Advocacy. And you can see why it would be very useful to have them or somebody like them working for you when it comes to this kind of situation with our medical system. And speaking of medical system, Dr. Zorba Pastor is coming up next, and we'll talk about, among other things, the new dietary guidelines. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. Pleased to welcome back Dr. Zorba Pastor. We're talking about new dietary guidelines, for one thing, with him. Dr. Zorba, of course, a retired physician, author, former host of the nationally syndicated WPR radio show, Zorba Pastor on Your Health, has a new podcast. It's called Stay Well with Dr. Zorba Pastor. And you can join the conversation with your own questions relating to health and comments. Give us a call. The number 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@WPR.org. Dr. Zorba, welcome back.
It's great to be here. I have to ask you, what is retirement?
You're not retired.
I'm asking you, what is retirement? That's exactly it.
Well, I don't think I'll start a podcast like you did. I mean, how's your podcast going?
Oh, it's really going well. We've had 100,000 downloads. We have a weekly update. We do 20, 25 minutes. We usually do five topics with Carl, my producer on WPR. And it's really going well. And the idea is you need good curated information, because there are a lot of scams out there. And the whole idea of even buying the podcast is people can then look at the information and make a decision for themselves. Yeah. And that's it. And that's actually what public radio has always been about. And that's what my podcast continuation is being about. And it's Stay Well with Dr. Zorba Pastor. And we've had a good response.
It's great. Let's turn our attention to the new dietary guidelines. Last week, I think it was the Federal Department of Health and Human Services released a new food pyramid and dietary guidelines. So maybe first, how's the pyramid changed?
Well, the pyramid is upside down.
Yeah.
Literally, when you look at it, it's upside down. So let's go back for just a minute. Do you remember when you were a kid, they had the four basic food groups? Mm-hmm. Now, I always joke about the four basic food groups in America were chocolate, sugar, starch, and grease, which meant that the chocolate donut, glazed donut, was the best food. It had chocolate, sugar, starch, and grease. But it was dairy. The idea was dairy. Mm-hmm. It was meat. It was fruits and vegetables. Those basically, and then it was fruits, and then it was vegetables. And that's at a time that we had vitamin deficiencies. So enter in then the food pyramid. And the idea behind the food pyramid was you had oil at the top. You had lots of grains at the bottom, saying grains were there. And when we started with that pyramid, our society became heavier and heavier and heavier. I mean, it really didn't work. So they went to myplate.gov. And, for all of these things, what do people remember anyway about it? I mean, if I asked you what was on my plate, I would say, well, I mean, I don't know. It's like fruits and vegetables. And so the idea behind this is teaching. So this pyramid is upside down. But there's been some buy-in by the AMA and the Pediatric Society. So let's look at the good stuff in there.
Okay.
So first of all, get real food.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what's wrong with that, right?
No, nothing.
Get real food. Michael Pollan wrote a book, and has an idea, which I think is relatively true. If you look at a label and it's got more than five ingredients, it's not real food. And I don't know if five is the magic number, but we have industrialized food. We have the food industrial complex making food that basically you want to eat, but has too much sugar, too much salt. And so the idea behind this is whole grains, whole food, real stuff. And, people have not, they don't cook at home. So real food, not created food. So if you look at, I did some research a little bit on this. So 500 million people a week, 500 million people a week eat at one of the 40,000 McDonald's locations worldwide.
Woo.
500 million people. 900,000 people in Wisconsin visit Taco Bell every week. 900,000, and it's their Crunchwrap Supreme, which is filled with oil and salt and sugar. That's the number one thing. So the point is, we have to stop eating these industrialized foods. So that's at the top. That's the first thing that they have, which I think is good. The second thing is early allergen exposures. So let me give an example. Science, it fits and starts, you know, makes good decisions, makes bad decisions, changes the data. And so about 15, 20 years ago, the Pediatric Society said, we're starting to see more and more peanut allergies in kids. So they said, we don't want to introduce peanuts early because it's going to be bad. Mm-hmm. You know, do it late because we have allergies. Meanwhile, there are more and more allergies. It turned out we were wrong. There was a study done now about 5 to 7 years ago, a long time ago, in England. And what they did was they discovered that children in Israel had very few peanut allergies. And the mothers in Israel give them something called Bamba peanut. It looks like a Cheeto, but it's made with peanuts. And once children were 6 months old, they started feeding them this. Why? They just did it because kids love it. And it turned out that produces a reduction in peanut allergies. And there was a major study that showed that if you gave peanuts like this early on, you didn't increase peanut allergies, you decreased it. Okay, major study, 5 years ago. The feds 5 years ago should have actually come out and said, we should do this. We should start giving peanuts at 6 months of old. We should start giving peanuts. We should start giving eggs. We should start giving fish to children because it will actually be good for them and reduce their allergies. You know, you don't want to do actual peanuts where they chew it. You can't chew it, but a peanut product. That's good. That's good in this new pyramid. Okay. Introduce that early. The next thing is dairy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, do you like skim milk?
No.
No. I don't like skim milk. You know, it's sort of colored water. How about 2%?
Well, it's better than skim.
That's exactly right. You got it. It's better than 1%. Come on. 1% is like close to skim. So 2% is what we eat. But I like whole milk. Well, now the idea is we should have whole milk. We should have full-fat yogurt. But we should have smaller amounts.
Hmm.
In other words, if you're going to have whole milk, you don't have to have full, you know, you're not going to have 4 12-ounce glasses of whole milk. But there's nothing wrong with that. And in fact, I think they're actually right. You know, the idea about milk, there's a lot of, you know, we threw out the baby with the bathwater when we said we shouldn't have too much meat. We shouldn't have saturated fats, which is true. But it turns out milk has some properties to it. It has calcium. And the idea of full-fat milk, about 2 years ago, I switched to full-fat milk and I drink less. But I love full-fat yogurt and I don't eat as much of it. So this is now the new guideline that the AMA has endorsed. The other thing is protein. Mm-hmm. So you might not get enough protein as a young adult. I mean, you know, you're an older adult. So what did you have for breakfast today?
I had a yogurt, mm-hmm. and I had a cutie.
A cutie. Oh, a cutie.
Yeah.
The orange, a cutie, right, which is good. What do you think you'll have for lunch? What do you typically have for lunch? What's your typical lunch?
Typically, I'll have some nuts.
Some nuts, good. Nuts
I'll
are
have
good.
Another fruit. I might have a banana, and I will have... probably 2 fruits. Uh-huh. I'll have an apple. Yeah. I have an apple every single day.
So you're getting good servings of fruits. Handful of nuts is good. It's high protein. Nuts are really, really good protein. What do you often have for dinner?
To be honest, something I make on Sunday.
What do you make?
I'll do a casserole. I've got a casserole sitting that I made on Sunday.
I do things like that. You make a meal, and then you make it so you can have it during the week.
Yeah, I am by myself, casserole is going to last me many a day.
Perfect. So you may not be getting enough protein. In other words, as an older adult, if you do an analysis, if you go to Google and do an analysis, you may not be getting the 70 grams of protein that you should be getting. So, and I finally, about maybe a year ago, thought about this, and I was walking through Costco, you know, looking at Costco, mm-hmm. and there are protein shakes there. You, for 180 calories, you can get 30 grams of protein. Okay, so it's not, it's very low calorie. A candy bar in America is generally 210 calories. So it's less than a candy bar. It's soy protein. You can get these protein shakes. They usually whey or, whey and casein. So they're either a dairy product or they're soy. And you get 30 grams of protein, and it's an easy way to up the protein that I think you need, especially as an older adult. And so in the new food guidelines, they're saying we don't get enough protein. Now, they're recommending, more beef, which I looked at this and I thought they don't realize the number one protein in America today is chicken. You know, mm-hmm. beef is more expensive, but chicken is a protein. Dairy protein is good, but... and then, of course, fish is good protein, and fish has good oil. That's excellent. But I think people should start thinking about protein shakes. That's the new emphasis in the food pyramid, that we're not emphasizing enough protein. And the old food pyramid did not talk about protein that much. Yeah. I mean, we didn't emphasize that. Now, the stuff that is goofy...
Okay.
Is you should be using beef tallow to do some of your cooking. Beef fat. Where'd that come from? And where do you get beef fat? I mean, you go to Woodman's and you buy beef fat. I mean, I think that's goofy. But so I think the idea, we should still decrease saturated fats. I think chicken is the protein of choice. I think fish is the best protein that we can possibly get because we have fish oil. There are good oils, not just that. But then they say children should not have a cookie until they're 10 years of age. try to do that. No added sugar until 10 years of age. They're right in one way. Go to the cereal aisle, just walk through the cereal aisle at Woodman's or any grocery store, and there's a lot of added sugar in the cereal aisle. I mean, cereals, cold cereals, are not the best thing for your kids. I mean, oatmeal is good, and mm-hmm. maybe a little bit of sugar on top, but not too much. We should reduce sugar in our kids, no doubt about it. They do it. But the idea that you're not going to have a cookie until you're 10 years of age is too Puritan. It's just too Puritan. So those are sort of the negative things. But I think the more protein idea is a good idea. I think real food, and we have to start cooking more and more for ourselves.
It is kind of fun.
Yeah, it is. I live by myself. I cook for myself. And I do what you do. I make a dish, and then I eat it throughout the week.
Yeah.
That's it.
David, we'll get to David's email in just a second. A reminder, Dr. Zorba Pastor, our guest today, his podcast is called, it took me a second there.
It's because I was on the radio for 35 years. That's right.
His new podcast is called Stay Well with Dr. Zorba Pastor. You can join in with your questions. The number to call, 800-642-1234. You can email the talk at WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks so much for joining us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here with Dr. Zorba Pastor. His podcast, Stay Well with Dr. Zorba Pastor. Great to have him with us. David emailed to say, doctors told us not to give honey to babies. Is this different from the peanut problem? Would kids be better off getting honey early, or is there a different reason honey is bad for infants?
Oh, sure. Well, the reason that honey is bad for infants has to do with botulism. Very, very rare cause. It's a rare event, and botulism can hide in honey. It used to be thought that only raw honey could hide it because, raw honey has never been sort of pasteurized or heated. Yeah. But there still is a rare event. So the answer is no. No honey until the child is 12 months old. That's easy. Now, that's not the same as the peanut issue, because honey allergy is really pretty rare, and peanuts are common. Peanuts are used in so many products.
Yeah,
there's so many things. So the peanut thing is really different. It's an early allergen. So I agree with the no honey for babies. Now, when, you know, our kids were young, we put honey. It wasn't, I mean, our kids are in their 40s. You know, we put honey sometimes on the pacifier. And when they were in the car to quiet them down. I think about that now and I go, oh, my God, how did we do that? So, you know, but the answer is no honey for babies. But you can go to the store and you can get these Cheeto-like peanut products. Bomba, B-O-M-B-A, is one of the names of the company. And at 6 months of age, every kid should get it, period. They should start eating peanut products. And, of course, it can be, it can be smooth peanut butter. You don't want the chunky stuff, right? Because kids can choke on it. Right.
Buck in Sturgeon Bay will give you a chance to join in. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Can you explain the difference between A1 protein and A2 protein milk?
I have no idea. I've never heard that. Where do you hear A1 and A2 protein milk? I'm not familiar with that differentiation.
Okay, well, I was having some digestion issues, and I like a lot of half and half with my coffee, and I started doing some research, and they kind of talked about the proteins in A1 milk. I'm like, well, what's this? So I go to the grocery store, and lo and behold, you know, there's the Fairlife, which is lower sugar, but this is completely different. It's called A2 protein milk, and they, you know, and I've met some people up here, because in Door County, we have a lot of Europeans that live here. Mm-hmm. And they say that Europe is mostly A2 milk, and we have mostly A1 milk, and it's just not as easily digested.
Yeah. First of all, I'm not familiar with that differentiation. But the issue with milk digestion is usually lactose intolerance. That's, like, the issue. And lactose intolerance has to do with the sugar and has nothing whatsoever to do with the protein. It's usually a sugar issue. If you look at African Americans, they are generally more milk intolerant. Northern Europeans, from an evolutionary point of view, started having dairy 2,000 years ago, and so they're more lactose tolerant. So lactose intolerance is less. Some people cannot tolerate milk, but can tolerate yogurt, because yogurt is digested differently. And also, they can do cheese. And the other issue with lactose intolerance, it can be the amount. So some people can have a little bit of cheese, but not a lot of cheese. But I don't think, I'm not familiar with this protein issue as being an issue. So
yeah,
can't answer it.
I just looked it up a bit. The A1 protein milk contains A1 beta casein protein, common in cows from Northern Europe.
Oh.
And it releases beta casomorphine.
Excellent. You're doing a good job.
Digestion potentially causing discomfort in both. And gas.
Well, see, you know something? That's the thing about science. Even at my age of 78, I can learn something about A1 and A2 protein. But I will, I'm going to do more research on that. And then I'm going to comment on that on my podcast, Stay Well with Dr. Zorba. So, you know, I don't have, when I did the radio show, I don't look at things automatically, but I'll do more research on that and see whether or not there really is a difference in terms of what that is and then what it is with our milk. But, you know, the Europeans, you know, always say that our stuff is not as good as their stuff. You know, like the French go, you know, the wheat, you know, your bread is not as good as our bread because, you know, we're special. And some of it is true and some of it is, I don't know. It's just, you know.
Buck, thanks a lot for calling. Dennis in Stevens Point, what's on your mind?
Well, thank you. Nice to hear your voice again, Dr. Zorba.
Oh, thank you.
So,
thank you.
I'm about your age, and about a year ago, I came down. I'm in very good health, but all of a sudden, all my thigh muscles, hamstring, biceps, thighs, all these muscles were just like, what's going on? Hard to even get out of a chair.
Wow.
So when I finally got a physician and I explained to him in about 30 seconds this melody, he said, You have, I'm quite positive, mm-hmm. polymyelitis rheumatica.
Rheumatica, uh-huh. PMR, yep.
And mm-hmm. he said, we'll yep. probably try yep. to send you to a rheumatologist. Mm-hmm. And just and then he did blood work, and yep. the inflammation mm-hmm. and all the markers mm-hmm. were not real definitive.
They're often not totally definitive. But PMR is easy, I mean... It's a common thing. I treated it in the office a lot. I mean, we don't know what causes it. The treatment is prednisone for a period of time until it settles down. That's generally the treatment. What were you put on, by the way?
Prednisone. And I started out with, I think, 10 milligrams. Mm-hmm. That made me feel like I was 18 years old.
Uh-huh, great. Larry and I are both laughing because we're thinking that'd be okay. 18 years old, like a movie.
Dennis, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it.
By the way, that is a PMR is common. You have something called elevated sed rate. It's a blood test. With another test in primary care, we often saw it. You make the diagnosis. There are really these joints you can't get up, and all of a sudden it's magic. You get prednisone, it gets better. It can take 3 months up to a year to settle down. You have to be careful with the prednisone and how you use it. And the diagnosis is a clinical diagnosis. That's exactly right. So
yeah,
that it got better.
Can you buy that over the counter?
Prednisone, no.
No, only, I didn't think so.
Only by prescription. And you have to be careful with the drug. It's got good effects and bad effects when it first came out. So JFK, if you look at him before he became president, he was incredibly thin. He had Addison's disease. He did not, which means you were not making cortisone, basically. And then around that time, he was literally, you know, after World War II, he probably would have died. They figured out what it was. It's not PMR. They invented hydrocortisone, and then he was on it. And prednisone is a type of cortisone. And he was then able to survive with his life. But then they gave it for arthritis, which is great. It gets your joints are good. But if you take it too long and too much, it actually destroys the joints.
No.
So you've got to be careful. Right. You've got to be careful. Use it in judicious amounts the right way. And so he said he felt like he was 18. So that's why he felt so good.
Dennis, thank you for calling. Jolene in Chippewa Falls, your turn. Hi, Jolene.
Yes, I just wanted to give a little more information on that A1, A2 milk. Yes, mm-hmm. it is a very real thing. Mm-hmm. Most of the cows in the United States are Holstein cows.
Oh,
Holstein cows,
wow.
For the majority of them, give A1 milk.
Mm-hmm.
Europe has a lot more diversified breeds, and many of those breeds give A2 milk.
Uh-huh.
When my mom was young, they said all the farms used to have a Jersey cow for baby milk.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
Well, baby milk was A2 milk, mm-hmm. or Jersey cows give A2 milk, so it was easier for the babies to digest.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah, uh-huh. if that gentleman has an issue, uh-huh. I don't know if he could find A2 cream, but... Yeah, there is a difference.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. Like I said, I'm going to do some research in it. I'm not aware of that. Thank you. Thank you so much for sharing that.
Jerseys, you know, the farms where I grew up out in the country and mm-hmm. farm. Our farmers, we had mostly Holsteins, but mm-hmm. We had a Jersey and a Guernsey cow, and maybe that was the reason.
Maybe that was the reason, because, you know, so many of the farms were started by Europeans who came here.
Yeah.
So maybe that was the reason behind it. What's interesting is, which I want to look at is, so there may be a difference in the protein. The question is, you know, then what studies have been done to show there's a difference in the digestion with that? So I don't know anything about it. I'm in the dairy state. I'm going to find out about it. I'll talk about it in my column, Stay Well with Dr. Zorba, pastor, and I'm glad she chimed in about that.
You know,
I mean.
Me too.
Yeah, that's right. I've learned something, yeah.
Ann in Neillsville, your turn. Hi, Ann.
Hello, Dr. Zorba and Larry Kneeler. I enjoy listening to you guys. I do not enjoy cooking.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
And mm-hmm. things that other people make in the frozen food aisle of the grocery store taste better than my cooking anyway. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. So I think, why cook when it tastes better from someplace else? Mm-hmm. But I try to focus on the low-calorie protein frozen meals. Mm-hmm. Now, am I feeding myself bad stuff?
You got to read the label. Look at the label. So if the label has 42 ingredients in it, there's a lot of preservatives. That's kind of the whole point. The whole point is, can you buy, you don't like cooking, which is fine, can you buy food that is frozen? So, for instance, freshly frozen vegetables, for instance, are often better than vegetables that you buy that look wilted. You know, I mean, so from a phrasing point of view, it's fine. So from a vegetable point of view within, you know, that what you're going to buy, it may be okay. The question is, what preservatives are they putting in it? That's the issue. So I haven't looked in the frozen food aisle to look at that, but I would go, if I were like you, I would go to the web and I would look up, I put in a number of variables. I would go frozen meals with minimal ingredients and no preservatives. And then I would go to the grocery store and I would look at the labels and see what's in there. And if it doesn't have much in the way of preservatives, that's probably a better thing to eat.
Yeah.
That's the way I would bird dog it or figure it out.
And, you know, I got to tell you, I usually have one or two of those sitting in my freezer. I'll be perfectly honest with you.
Sure.
Because if you get home late.
Yeah, right.
And, you know, and I already used up my hot dish from the weekend.
Right. Yeah.
I'm going to throw one of those in and so, 3 minutes later.
So maybe now you should look at the label of the different frozen foods and see which one has fewer preservatives and go to a big grocery store where they have a big variety.
Yeah.
And then
I shop at Woodman's usually. So.
Woodman's is great. And then do some due diligence of looking through all of those frozen foods and see which one might be the best.
Yeah. You know? And thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. The number to call, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email to talk at WPR.org. Dennis in Two Rivers emailed to say he remembers you, Zorba, recommending the use of dietary supplements for 2 weeks, then stopping for 2 weeks, and then repeating that. This is to check whether supplements are beneficial or have placebo effects. Would 2 weeks be enough to determine someone's threshold levels for a therapeutic benefit, he wonders.
Well, that, by the way, is an excellent question. You know, I usually say 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off, and repeat that 3 times. You know, it depends on how someone feels. I think generally a 2 weeks, if you're going to feel something, you're going to feel it. On the other hand, there's nothing wrong with 1 month on, 1 month off, and repeating that 3 times. But often if people are taking a supplement, let's say, for joint pain, if it's going to do something, it's generally going to do something within 2 weeks. So I think the 2 week threshold is pretty much there. But other people may argue that it's not long enough. So you can do 1 month on, 1 month off. But I'm going to stick with the 2 week idea, because if I put somebody on a medication, like an anti-inflammatory medication, I might use a cream, I expect that I'm going to see a response in 2 weeks. You know, if you look at diclofenac cream, which is an anti-inflammatory cream, so you're not taking an anti-inflammatory that you don't want to take it because it may upset your stomach or it may affect your kidneys. Generally, if you're going to see a response, you're going to get it in 2 weeks. So I'm going to stick with the 2 weeks.
Yeah. If you're taking something like fish oil.
Well, but people take fish oil for arthritis.
Yeah.
You know, they're going to do it. Now, from a heart disease point of view, that's a different thing. You're not going to see it. You take it from a prevention. And fish oil has some plus minus things. I always say you should eat fish. And the way you can tell the difference is take a bite of salmon, really good salmon, and compare that to a capsule of fish oil. Poke the capsule of fish oil and put that in your mouth. See which tastes better. You know, get some fatty fish. Eat sardines. I love sardines. Do you like sardines, by the way?
Yeah, I do.
Sardines are great. They have a tremendous amount of fish oil. And sardines are inexpensive. They're easy to get. And a can of sardines is not many calories. I think it's 180 or 250 calories. It's a high protein. Sardines are a high protein, good fat dish, easy to eat.
What about, let's see, what was I going to say? I forgot what I was going to ask you about. Oh, tuna fish. You know, a can of tuna fish. Do you get it with the water added or
I get it with the oil.
Or with the oil.
I get it with olive oil. The olive oil is good. And I now buy a more expensive tuna. I can't remember the name of it. You can get it at Woodman's. It costs more and it tastes better. It's called something like Toronto. It's not Toronto, but it starts with a T. Tonito. I think it's Tonito. I had it once, and I can't go back to regular tuna. It costs more. It's at Costco also, but it's an incredibly good taste. So I used to get water tuna, and that's like to me skim milk now. I want to get a better taste. You know, that's the way it is.
John in Wisconsin Dells, we'll go to you now. Hi, John.
How's it going?
Good. Appreciate the call. What can we do for you?
Okay, so I have a personal issue problems with my digestive system. But every time I would talk to my doctor or the barman, because I get these hot sweats that go with it, too, like out of nowhere. Like, I just get really hot. It can be cold outside. I just start sweating. But it only lasts just like 30 seconds to a minute. Can that be related to a digestive system?
Well, maybe. You know, these things that affect our body. So it may not be the digestive. It may be what's added to whatever you're eating. And, you know, a lot of these things have not been studied. And so, people often who are gluten intolerant, but do not have, don't have gluten intolerance, which is such that, terrible gluten intolerance, get rid of wheat and they say they feel better. So from a dietary issue, you experiment and you see, because there's no absolute one way or another. So difficult to say.
Yeah, makes sense, John. Thank you for calling. Jan in Wausau, your turn. Hi, Jan.
Hi, guys. I love both your shows. Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you.
I just had a comment on Dr. Pastor's looking at the labels on frozen foods, which is excellent. It's perfect. Another thing that might help is an app, and the app is called Yucca, Y-U-K-A.
Uh-huh, Yucca.
It's free to download, mm-hmm. and if you pay a $15 a year fee, mm-hmm. you can take that little scanner, mm-hmm. and you can scan the barcodes of any of those foods, and it'll tell you
what's
sodium.
In the... Oh, that's fabulous.
It'll give you a green dot, orange dot, or a red dot, depending on, good, better, best, whatever.
Oh, you may have a green dot, orange dot. Oh, that is great. So it's called yucca.com. So it's a green dot.
It's an app. It's an app. That means it's excellent or a score of like 80 out of 100 or more.
It's great. I love it.
And
then
if it's got some food additives or too much salt or too much fat, it'll drop it down to a red or an orange dot. Anyway, the other thing it's good for is cosmetics. I've really found it helpful for discerning what's in these cosmetics.
So wait a minute. So if I get a green and I use that cosmetic, I'll look like I'm 18 again? That's what I want to know. I want to just get rid of all I want to get rid of all the wrinkles in the face so I can puff out so I can look like I'm 18. I just want to know, that's the cosmetic. It's not. How about I'd even go from back to like 50. That would be okay too.
Well, I tell you what though, with cosmetics, I mean, I saw some articles about the amount of lead.
Yes.
In some cosmetics, as an example.
Yes, right.
And Jan, that's probably what that Yucca app may be pointing to as well for cosmetics.
It'll do food, and then it'll do products that it has information on. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
But that is great. That is a great idea. Yucca.com. I've not heard of the app. I think I may have heard of other apps. And we've gotten used to the fact that we don't have to pay for apps. $15. I mean, think about that. Yesterday, I decided I was going to stop at my favorite Chinese restaurant and just get a dish because I didn't feel like cooking. Mm-hmm. So I went home, got the dish, and the dish was $15. Mm-hmm. Now, I can eat that for a couple of nights. I didn't finish the whole dish. But $15 over is not, it may seem like...
a buck a month.
It's a buck a month. And if it's going to improve your health, that's an excellent idea. So that's... That is excellent. I'm going to, I'm learning a lot on this. I've got to do A1 protein and after you, yucca.com. I'm supposed to be the one giving advice.
Well, that's the beauty of this program.
Yes.
You get a lot of good advice from people. And I mean, you can take it or not, but you can look and learn more. And why not?
Yeah. And that's what public radio really shines, because you have people who are educating themselves, listening, and then want to give that information back about that and talk about that. And that's kind of that's why public radio is great.
Jan, thank you very much for your comments. I wrote it down too. I'm going to take a look at that app.
Well, you should use it when you look at frozen entrees in the grocery store and look at that and see which one is the best, which company.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Jan. Let's go to Courtney in Rio. Hi, Courtney.
Hi. Thank you both for having a great program. Quick shout out to my husband who's listening. Hi, Vic. thank you both for being here. my question today is about vegan protein for toddlers. We have had to currently adjust our diet for medical reasons, and I'm struggling to get her to eat some of the whole foods that we shoot for. Mm-hmm. We do an organic whole food diet, so quinoa has not been a hit yet, maybe throwing against the wall.
How old is your youngin?
She is 3 years old.
Okay.
Throwing against the wall.
It's been fun to play with. Maybe not to eat, though. We've tried black beans. That's not a hit. Try to incorporate hemp seeds because those have a good amount of protein and like smoothies. But just wondering if you have any other suggestions for vegan whole food proteins.
That's a tough one. It's very tough. It's just tough because a vegan diet is limited. But people just do that and they then insist they try to, they try to sort of fuss it up with the right type of basic things that can be on there that make it taste better. You know, you're not disguising it, but you're adding to it. Just like we add hot sauce to things because we like the taste of hot sauce. I think it's how you make it, how you prepare it. So if you give something vegan that's tasteless, kids are not going to eat it. But if you find a sauce that you can then, it's not disguising the vegan, but it's making it more digestible. That would be the way that I would do things. Now, the French are really interesting. They're not into veganism, but there was a book, I can't remember, about French food and how a woman went to France with her kids and discovered that they introduced many, many different foods early on, not at 3 years of age, but earlier. It's at 6 months and 1 year of age. And it's that variety of foods that can make a difference. But I would sauce it up. That's what I would do. If I were looking at, but that's it. Yeah,
quinoa. 3 years old. Would you add honey?
Yes, you could add a certain amount of honey, but once again, then how sugary are you going to do it?
Yeah,
could you add a vegan ketchup to things? That's what I mean from other sauces. Once again, read the labels and see what it is, and that's what I would suggest doing.
Courtney, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. And just a reminder here, you're listening to Dr. Zorba Pastor, his podcast, Stay Well with Dr. Zorba Pastor. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks so much for joining us here on WPR News as we visit with Dr. Zorba Pastor. And great to have him back to answer your medical questions or concerns. We've talked a lot about diet. And, of course, we're taking other questions as well. 800-642-1234. Linda in Sheboygan has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Linda.
Hi. Hi. I have two kind of issues. First of all, the fellow that was talking about the sweating, I have that. And I think it's related to an autoimmune illness I have. I never noticed it until I was diagnosed with this autoimmune illness, and it's just very weird. It can come on very fast, can have sweat running down my back, and after a while, I'm fine.
Right, so it's, and you're exactly correct. It can be. There are a number of things that can be related. It used to be one of the symptoms of tuberculosis when TB was common in our society. It was sweating. One of the things you would do is check someone for TB. TB is not very common here, but in India, where I do some humanitarian work, it's common. And if somebody sweats, you immediately, you know, question TB. And TB, of course, it's because of the immune response to that. So good point. Very good, good point.
And also, I think I may have something called gastroparesis.
Gastroparesis.
Yes, and the doctors are kind of blowing me off. So I'm just wondering if you have an idea of foods to eat that will lessen the symptoms.
Well, gastroparesis is where you don't, your stomach doesn't really empty, the gut doesn't empty the right way. Come from a variety of things. There's a drug called metoclopramide, an old drug, which has been around for a long time. Reglan was the name brand, useful for this. We often don't recommend it forever because it can have side effects with it. But I think you ought to Google gastroparesis. Look it up. This, by the way, from a food point of view, I don't know any specific foods, but this is a good time to use AI. So what I would do is I would go to ChatGPT, and then I would go to Gemini, which is which I think is either in Google or Microsoft, and then I would go to Microsoft, and I would put in, when you use AI, AI works very well once you get to three or four more variables. So I would put in gastroparesis, I would put in your age, I would put in foods that work. I'd probably put in what's bad, what's good, and then I would do some searching because there may be something out there. There may be a text or a study or something else that might recommend foods that would work for you. And this is where I think AI has a value, because I might do that in my office. There's an AI app that physicians can use called Open Evidence, which is excellent for this. But I would go and look at that, because this is a good example. They might find, yeah, this food is good, that food is bad. And then I would try it out, and I would try it out for a month or two and see what happens.
Yeah, there you go, Linda. Thank you. Pamela in Ridgeway, we'll go to you. Hi, Pamela.
Hi there. Thank you. I have a question. I am wondering if there are new dietary guidelines for dealing with hypertension.
Well, first of all, the hypertension, the dietary guideline is the DASH diet, the D-A-S-H. So the DASH diet is diet, I can't remember, hypertension. The H stands for hypertension. The D stands for diet, and it's an acronym. It's been around for years. It's been updated and changed, and if you have hypertension, that's the guideline to follow, period. It works well if you follow it correctly, and it's a reduction of salt, obviously, and it's an increase in potassium foods, which are generally fruits and vegetables. But the DASH diet has been shown to reduce blood pressure by 5 to 7 millimeters, or rather 5 to 7 mg per, 5 to 7 drop in systolic and diastolic blood pressure, but it's good. So I'd do the DASH diet. I wouldn't look at the inverted pyramid. The DASH is the way to go.
Allison Madison, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Thank you for taking my call. I really appreciated your point about cooking for yourself. I'm 73, and I cook almost all of my own meals from scratch, and I think it's one of the best things that I do for my health. But the question I have is, I was recently diagnosed with Hashimoto's, and I think that
Hashimoto's thyroiditis, right?
Right. It's, I think it's inflammatory, and so I've been trying to reduce inflammation in my diet. I'm trying to go gluten-free and do some other things as well, and I'm wondering if you have any other suggestions for diet in dealing with Hashimoto's.
Not specifically, and there have been questions about Hashimoto's thyroiditis. Basically, it's an inflammatory disease that that works in your thyroid, so your thyroid over time, doesn't do what it should do, and then you need thyroid replacement. That's what it is. And a lot of people who have hypothyroidism, low thyroid, actually have Hashimoto's thyroiditis. We don't know exactly what causes it. We're not really sure. Why does the body attack itself? There's no evidence. I've never read anything that shows that diet will do something to reduce that. And the answer with that is you then eat thyroid replacement. And so you go in the office, you get something called the TSH test, and then you have to take thyroid replacement because your thyroid's not producing as much. And that's what most people, that is the most common cause of low thyroid. And luckily, we can make synthetic thyroid, which makes a difference. When I started out with medicine, thyroid either came from bovine sources or pig sources. So in the slaughterhouse, they would take out the thyroid, you know, put it down, and they would basically distill the thyroid from either the cow or the cattle. Mm-hmm. And that's what we would have. And it was not as good as it was not as good as the present thyroid. You would have thyroid extract, which came from that. And some people still now believe that that's better than the synthetic thyroid, but synthetic thyroid works well. So good luck. I don't have an answer for that.
Yeah, thank you very much for calling. Lee Rayburn, our technical director, found talking about the tuna, back to that for a minute. Mm-hmm. Tonino.
Tonino. Excellent. It is. Thank you. It is the best. If you love tuna and you're willing to spend that extra money, get the. Do you like tuna?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Have you ever? You've got to
try it. I've never had it.
You got to go try it. Try it in the olive oil. It's unbelievable. I had it maybe 25 or 30 years ago, and then I didn't know the name of it. And then one day I found it at Woodman's. I actually found it at Walmart and then at Woodman's, and I'm stuck on it. Thanks for looking that up. It's the best. I don't get any money from advertising them at all.
All right. Well, let's turn to Bob in Janesville then and find out what's on Bob's mind. Hi, Bob.
Good morning, everybody. I enjoy the show very much. I have been diagnosed with GERD, and I've had a throat scope, and had it says there are some damage there. And so I was prescribed pantoprazole, and that was very upsetting to my stomach. And I'm on famotidine.
Mm-hmm. Famotidine.
And my question is, I understand the issues involved, but my stomach seems to be bothering me more with the medications than without. And I don't understand that.
Yeah. Well, first of all, if you look at GERD, there's some things that we do actually in terms of eating. So first of all, no food after a certain time before you go to sleep, 2 to 3 hours before you go to sleep. No alcohol, no coffee. There really are GERD things that you should avoid. Alcohol is a big no-no for GERD. And then small meals at the end of the day. So you want to look at all the lifestyle things. If you go and look at Mayo Clinic GERD or you do UW Health GERD, you'll get some good information on there on what to do. Now, famotidine is called an H2 blocker. It can work well. The PPIs like Prilosec, which is over-the-counter, are better and work better. One, the famotidine blocks the receptors that the acid, stomach acid, goes on. The PPIs like Prilosec slow down the acid. And for some people, both work together. You take a Prilosec, you know, like you did, in the morning on an empty stomach, 1/2 hour before you have anything to eat. That's the way to do it. If you're not doing it that way, you should do it that way. You'll get a better result, and the famotidine in the evening. But I don't know why it's worse for you, but then you have to go to lifestyle issues.
Yeah.
That's what you do.
Bob, thank you for calling. Therese in Green Bay recommended, this is back to hummus for a minute for the younger child. Hummus is now available in various flavors, she says. And so there may be one the child likes the taste
of. Sure, exactly. And it, once again, we were talking about flavoring and saucing what you have. And so when you look at hummus and you look at things of that nature and you look at nuts that you're feeding with the kids, it's what you're actually putting on there that can make a difference. Textures and taste. And children have their own things that they like. I mean, you know.
Yeah.
Did you like tomatoes as a kid?
Yeah, I did.
See, I hated tomatoes. I hated them. I love tomatoes now, but I hated tomatoes. But I love ketchup. Yeah.
Dr. Zorba Pastor, our guest today, it's great to have him. And he'll be coming by every so often to talk with us.
And
his podcast, in the meantime, go to his podcast, Stay Well with Dr. Zorba Pastor. Quick reminder, tomorrow we're going to talk about mining on the program, and then we'll be taking a look at sharp-tailed grouse in Wisconsin with someone from the DNR, and then we'll talk about the herbicide Roundup with historian Barto Elmore. So that tomorrow. But in the meantime, thank you for listening, and thanks to our team for creating our shows, Clara Neipert, Joel Patnod, Lee Rayburn, and Jeff Robbins, our executive producer, Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.